there's this culture within the first responder community and the military community that, you know, you suck it up, you just deal with it. You don't talk about feelings. You don't talk about emotions. The truth is that suicide is the number one killer for not just military members, but also for first responders. We are much more likely to die by our own hands than the hands of another. And so my primary mission and goal in life is to help stop this suicide epidemic amongst our first responders and our military members.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins, the weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
All right. Well, today we're joined by a special guest, Michael Sergrew. And he is a U.S. Air Force veteran, a special division of that, and a police sergeant for Walnut Creek Police Department, and also co-author of a best-selling book called Relentless Courage. And so we're excited to talk about this intersection, not only between crime and addiction, but then trauma within the first responder community and efforts to, you know, try and battle that. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So would you mind just starting, just for the listeners, kind of giving some background? I think you started maybe Police Explorers and then went to Air Force and then eventually to Walnut Creek Police Department. But like, how did you get into all of that and kind of that background?
So I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my interest in the military and law enforcement actually started as a child. Mm-hmm. My stepfather was a police sergeant, eventually a police lieutenant. But I ended up being a volunteer for his department at 8 years old, eventually a police explorer. And my plan was to go into college and potentially federal law enforcement like the DEA or the FBI, marshals. I ended up getting a full scholarship through the Air Force ROTC program to California State, Sacramento. And initially, I was just going to serve my 4 years, get out of the Air Force and go into the feds. But a lot of things happened. A lot of things changed. I ended up going into security forces, which was my first choice. And that's pretty much military and law enforcement, anti-terrorism, force protection, airbase ground defense, nuclear security. I served all over the world, South America, the Middle East, Europe, all over the United States. I ended up staying in a bit longer, so 6.5 years. Mm-hmm. Got out as a captain in 2004. And at that point, I was back in California, and I decided that I actually wanted to work local law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So I applied to a bunch of different agencies. I got hired by the Walnut Creek Police Department, which is also in the San Francisco Bay Area. And that's where I started my civilian law enforcement career. Okay. Did a bunch of different things, from just patrol officer to a field training officer, detective. I was undercover on a California State Drug Task Force, eventually promoted to sergeant, where I was running patrol teams on the street.
Okay. So I had never heard of your, when you were in the Air Force, the Phoenix Ravens, this, you know, elite group that you were a part of. And it was just interesting. Do you mind like sharing a little bit about that? It sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. So it's a subset of security forces members. So to be a Phoenix Raven, you have to first be in security forces. Mm-hmm. And this actual program started in 1997. And it's a specialized program where the Phoenix Ravens are attached to aircraft and air crew, and their job is when the air crew and aircraft go to hostile environment or dangerous areas, they're directly responsible for the security and protection of both the aircraft and the air crew. Mm-hmm. And so you go through specialized training at Fort Dix in New Jersey. It's very intense, has a high washout rate. They do things like cross-cultural communication, dynamics of international terrorism, advancements in like takedown techniques, baton techniques, self-defense. They also do like air marshal training, where we're trained to go on dignitary flights or also contracted military aircraft and do air marshal duty. So there's a whole bunch of different things that you do. Sure. But when you graduate, you're actually given a number, and these numbers are given in chronological order. Mm-hmm. And you're the only one that ever gets that number. So when I went through, I went through as a captain when I was stationed at Travis Air Force Base in California. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated, my number was 1173. And now, so you look at the program started in 97. I went through in 2003, 2004. And now We're, I think, up to just almost 4,000 Ravens in the history of the United States Air Force, going all the way back to 1997. So,
Pretty
for
elite group
me,
then.
yeah, and for me, it's one of the proudest achievements that I have. I take great pride in being a Phoenix Raven. And like you said, a lot of people don't know about it. They do know about it in the Air Force, but a lot of people outside of the Air Force have probably never heard of the program.
Sounds very necessary, though. Some of those
Absolutely.
planes are very expensive, and people that are going to be flying on them and stuff need to be protected. So,
Absolutely.
yeah, cool. So, okay, so police department, you go into Walnut Creek. Now, the work that you did with drug enforcement, was that after you joined Walnut Creek, before you joined Walnut Creek?
Yeah, so the way it worked was we had a regional task force, and it was a task force run by the state of California, the Department of Justice. So basically, like the state version of the DEA. And the boss was actually from the state of California. And what they did was they would have an officer detective from different agencies within the county that were assigned to this task force, usually for anywhere from a 4 to 7 year period. And so, like in my task force, we had a CHP officer, we had an FBI agent attached, we had people from the sheriff's department, and from numerous cities within Contra Costa County, which is the county that I worked in. And so that assignment occurred about 9 years, or actually 5 years, into my civilian police department career. So I started with Walnut Creek in 2004, and in 2009 is when I began that undercover assignment. And so it's like you're on temporary loan to the state of California, but when you're done with the assignment, you come right back to your police department.
Did you do the typical undercover, grow the hair long, basically looking like somebody on the streets?
I did, yeah. So I mean, the first thing I did is I shaved my head completely. I pierced both my ears, put these huge diamond studs in my ears on both sides. Ended up growing a long goatee, changed the way I dressed, changed the way I acted, and I loved it because no one had any clue that I was actually a law enforcement officer. And just the intensity, the danger, the risk, I mean, everything about it was just, I mean, constant adrenaline dumps. And you come from a city like Walnut Creek, which was an upscale, very nice city, kind of a destination city for shopping, for dining. We had crime, of course, like every city, but it wasn't considered a dangerous area. And by going to this task force, I got to work in some of the worst cities, not just in our county, but also outside our county, and got to work on just major level cases with mid to high level drug traffickers, something that normal police officers don't get to deal with on the street. So it really was a unique opportunity.
What was going to family functions like when you look like that?
Well, the funny thing was I was married at the time, and I remember my wife, she got pregnant and was pregnant when I went undercover. And I'll never forget, because when I would go to these like prenatal appointments and doctor's appointments, like the way they would just look at me, it was almost like they would like look at her and then look at me, and they thought something was wrong, and they'd always check on her and make sure she was okay, and ask her a bunch of questions. And I mean, I would even get followed around in stores. Like, I kid you not, like people would think like I was stealing or shoplifting. And I even remember when I was off on the weekend, and this was after we had our daughter, but we went wine tasting somewhere, and I remember like I just got completely ignored. Like nobody wanted to serve me, like nobody wanted to talk to me. And it really was eye-opening. I mean, just to see the difference of how I was treated, because I was the same person. I just changed the way that I dressed. I changed my hairstyle. And I mean, just the lack of respect and the difference in treatment was really astonishing.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So with the drug enforcement stuff, because our podcast is, about addiction as a whole of society problem, and so since you have that unique perspective, I mean, how much of an issue did you see? That was what, 2009, you said, when you finished up with that or started that?
Oh, that's when I started it, actually. So I worked undercover from 2009 to 2011.
Okay, so how big of a problem was it then? And I don't know if you're in the loop now, like seeing the expansion of that. I mean, it's our opinion that if you want to deal with crime in general, You're not gonna all be able to totally do it without also addressing substance abuse, addiction, those types of things. Because not every crime is a drug related crime, but behind those crimes, a lot of times are substance abuse. So just looking to see your perspective on that.
Well, I can tell you, and I'm in tune to now, today, presently, and as well as back then. And from the start of my law enforcement career in 2004, addiction and drug use were a major problem. And I would say, in my own experience, that the majority of crimes, not all, but the vast majority have some tie to drug use or drug addiction. Like a lot of times people steal, whether that's shoplifting, breaking into cars, breaking into people's houses, but they're doing this to find items that they can sell for money and then go immediately and buy more drugs to feed their addiction. And it's this vicious cycle. A lot of things have changed. Like back in 2009 in California, believe it or not, marijuana was pretty much still illegal. And so if you had even concentrated hash oil back then, just a tiny, tiny bit, that was considered a felony. And so, we also didn't have fentanyl back then. Our big things were methamphetamine, heroin, Oxycontin, pills, those types of things. But now with the fentanyl, I mean, you're dealing with something totally different. And, as we know, people are overdosing and dying, unfortunately, every single day in pretty much every single city across the entire United States. And so I do agree with you that if we really want to reduce crime, or prevent crime or stop crime, however you want to look at it or however you want to word at it, we absolutely do need to deal with the drug addiction issue, because one is not going to go away without the other. As long as we have people addicted to drugs, then they're going to have to find the means when they run out of money or they, lose their jobs and they lose everything they have to feed this addiction. For me, I look at addiction totally different now. I mean, I'll be completely honest with you, when I was a police officer, I was a very black and white person. And again, I don't mean that with ethnicity or race. I mean that by if you committed a crime, I didn't care why you were committing the crime. It was literally you broke the law and you're either going to get a ticket for as many things I can write you a ticket for, or I'm going to arrest you and I'm going to stack every single charge that I can on you for every single crime and violation that you've committed. And my only interest was proving that crime. So that way, we arrest the person, we send the case to the district attorney, they prosecute it, and with a good arrest, a good case, that person does jail time or prison time or maybe probation, what have you. And I do know though that a lot of times that jail time and that prison time can actually turn people's life around in a good way where they actually hit that rock bottom and they decide, you know what? I can't do this anymore. Like, I need to get clean. I need to get over this addiction. And so I've seen that as well. I've seen both ends.
Well, a world without consequences for our actions is not going to be a pleasant world.
No, absolutely not. But I'll tell you that the ironic thing is, I'm no longer a police officer, but all the trauma and all the things that I've been through in my life, I now look at addiction and alcoholism completely differently. And I don't judge people. I actually understand that there's a root oftentimes to these addictions. And whether that's, childhood trauma for many people or something that happened in their life. But people just don't wake up one day and go, you know what? I want to be an addict. Oftentimes they're turning to drug and alcohol to cope with all these things that they're dealing with and they just want to escape from it. And now in the work that I do, with a volunteer with the West Coast Post Trauma Retreat, having gone through Save a Warrior and have, speaking across the nation to first responders, firefighters, paramedics, police officers, dispatchers. I can't tell you how many people that I've met who are addicted to either drugs or alcohol or both, and they're trying to use that to cope with their post-traumatic stress.
Sure. I think in that first responder world, don't you guys call it maladaptive coping mechanisms, or just using things that are not healthy in themselves and cause more damage to deal with, trauma or PTSD or something like that?
Absolutely. Most often it's either extramarital affairs, it's gambling addictions, it's porn addictions, alcohol addictions, drug addictions. But again, it's to escape that reality and to numb yourself. to just forget about all these horrific things that we've had to see and deal with over the span of our career as first responders.
Sure. So you said there was a change, right? You kind of, when you went into the police department, you viewed things, very dogmatically, and this is the way it is. And now, you've softened to understand there's underlying things. And obviously, something happened between there, right? And I'm assuming it was the things that you went through in your book starting in 2012. And so, would that be accurate? Those things, the trauma that you went through and dealing with that stuff just, shape the view you have now.
Absolutely. What happened in 2012, and I'll touch on that briefly, but I'll say that, as first responders, and I'm speaking for myself, but I'm also speaking from my experience of working with others, there's this culture within the first responder community and the military community that, you suck it up, you just deal with it, you don't talk about feelings, you don't talk about emotions. And I mean, literally, for my first week as a police officer, I was exposed to just horrific incidents. I mean, things that people should never have to see or deal with, but that's our job. And we literally go from call to call to call. And so, over this span in 2012, I had already had 6.5 years military experience. And by that point, I had 8 years both on the street as a patrol officer, and then years as a detective and also an undercover special agent on a drug task force. And so there was hundreds of incidents that I never processed, I never dealt with, I never talked about. I just kept them all bottled up inside. And the end of 2012, I was involved in a fatal shooting where, unfortunately, I had to take the life of somebody who was trying to kill a couple barricaded inside their condominium, and then he tried to kill us. And I call that incident my tipping point. It wasn't just that it was that incident, but it was that incident that kind of filled up my jar, just been filling up over my career. And that incident just caused everything to just start coming out. And it's where I hit rock bottom. I mean, I literally lost my marriage, my health started to fail, my career was going down, and it got to the point where I did not want to be here anymore. It was so bad that I was purposely trying to get myself killed in the line of duty because I didn't want to be here anymore. And, it was thankfully 4 years after that, I finally got the strength and courage to ask for help. But that's what changed everything for me. And that's what started my path and my road to recovery from post-traumatic stress. And that's really where my views, my perceptions, my judgment, where everything changed in that process.
Yeah, for sure. When you go through things like that, it opens your eyes. And so, yeah, so maybe just share a little bit about, the things that are going on right now. I know you're involved in a lot of different ways to impact this community. And so maybe you can share some of those things.
I'll say first and foremost, being a father and being present is my number one thing that I do. I really am fully retired, but I do speak occasionally across the country. I limit it to only 4 to 5 times max a year. I don't want to get back in that rut where I put my career, my profession ahead of my family. And so I really prioritized my own, not just my physical health, but my mental health and being present for my loved ones. So I do speak. I do have a speaking engagement coming up in October in New York. I'm looking forward to that, but it does take a lot out of me as well. When I speak, I don't use any slides. I literally show a short 9-minute film. It's called The Stigma of Help. Anybody can find it on YouTube. It was made by Mission 22, which is a nonprofit for combat veterans and first responders. And then I get up on stage and I literally speak for 3, 3.5 hours, and I literally bare my entire soul to everybody in that audience. And I just rip it open every single time. And a lot of what I talk about is the mistakes that I made, the many mistakes that I made. I want people to learn from them. I want them to make those different decisions while they still have time. Because the truth is that suicide is the number one killer for not just military members, but also for first responders. And we are much more likely to die by our own hands than the hands of another. And so my primary mission and goal in life is to help stop this suicide epidemic amongst our first responders in our military members. And so when I'm not out speaking, I like to do interviews like this, where I can be at home, I can etch out an hour of my time, but I can reach a whole new audience. And again, I want people that watch this or listen to know that you can reach out to me. I'm on pretty much every social media platform you can imagine. I check my messages daily. And, if you need resources, if you need me to point you in the right direction of where to seek help, I want to do that. I want you to realize that you're not alone. I mean, there's really, I never knew this, but there's countless resources out there to get help, whether it's for addiction or post-traumatic stress or marital problems or family problems. There's just endless resources available to you, and it's never too late to ask for help.
Yeah, absolutely. We had I don't know if you saw, we had one episode. We had Devin O'Day from First Responder Wellness on, and he shared, some of the things that they're doing there in Newport Beach, and there's a lot more awareness to it. And like what you said with the stigma and just having this, tough guy persona that you can't talk about it, and just kind of breaking into that and letting people know that there's options. Well, you said, that you on these speaking engagements, you go through some, really the bulk of it is you listing some of the, mistakes that you've made in trying to get people to learn. Are you able to just share a few of those?
I would say one of the biggest mistakes I made early on was when I was in the police academy. I decided that I would never talk about the job, or I'd never bring work home, because I thought I was protecting my family. I thought I was protecting my loved ones. And what I ended up doing was I created a barrier with my wife at the time. I'm divorced now. I'm engaged though. I have a phenomenal partner,
Oh,
and
congratulations.
so I'm very happy, doing very well. But back then, when I would come home pissed off in a bad mood because of something horrific I had to see or deal with on the job, I never vented or opened up and just let it off my chest. And what I should have done from the beginning was started an open communication where I can come home and not share the gritty, gory details, but to simply say, look, I had a really bad day today. I just need to go for a run or go to the gym for an hour. I'll be back and we can sit down. We can have dinner, we can talk. I can share you a little bit about what happened and just let you know how I'm feeling about it. I didn't do that, because I thought if I would have done that, I would have scared them. I would have made them fear that, what I was doing at work, and they wouldn't want me to go to work and do this job. But in reality, I was creating a division and a barrier where when this shooting happened in 2012, when literally I hit rock bottom, I didn't have that support network at home. And I didn't believe at that time in therapists. I didn't believe in peer support. And we had all those resources. Not that I don't think anybody was using them back then, they are now, but I didn't believe in those resources. I didn't trust them. And so I literally felt like I was on an island where I couldn't even talk to my own coworkers because I didn't want them to think I was weak, by talking about these things, how they were affecting me, or talking about my feelings or showing emotion. And then at home, I had nobody. And again, I didn't have those resources because I didn't trust them. And so, what I tell people is it's never too late to open up that dialogue and to start these discussions. And one phenomenal thing about my book, Relentless Courage, is that it's not just a gut-wrenching true life story, my story, but every chapter, a clinical psychologist who is an expert in working with military members and first responders. She comes in and breaks everything down. She explains it. She shows the true impact of the job, not just on us, but on our family members, our loved ones. And together we show a pathway to healing. And the coolest thing I get, because I get messages all the time, but when a spouse or a partner decides to read or listen to Relentless Courage on Audible, and then they have their husband or wife, the one that's a first responder, do the same. And then for the very first time, they're able to come together and have this conversation because it lays the foundation. It literally, because like, what are the odds that you're reading a book and this guy from California you don't know, and he's actually telling your story in the book and explaining why your partner is acting the way they're acting and why they're doing the things that they're doing. And it shows that, look, it's not just them. I mean, this is happening to everybody. But I didn't think that. I didn't know that. I thought it was only me. I thought there was something wrong with me. And that's the key, is that people need to realize, A, there is nothing wrong with you. This is a normal reaction to all the abnormal things that we have to see and deal with. And what we need to normalize is talking about it, right? But we don't do that. We make it abnormal. And that's where we need to change this culture. And I call it smash the stigma and really just make it okay to talk about how these things affect us. I think if we can do that and we have that open culture where we're not judged, where our job's not in jeopardy, where assignments or promotion are not put in jeopardy, I think we can get through a full career and come out healthy on the other side.
Okay, so that's one of the lessons that you learned. What are a couple more that you wouldn't mind sharing with the audience?
I would say one of the biggest mistakes was that I put my career in front of my family. Both in the military, and I was single in the military, but when I went into law enforcement, I wanted to be chief of police someday. And I was trying to do everything that I could to get that next special assignment, to get that next, promotion. And I worked graveyard shift all the time. I missed out on holidays. I missed out on important functions at school, sporting events, those types of things. And the reality is that no job is more important than your family, than your loved ones. I mean, that is the most important thing in this world
Would you say your
because
identity was like wrapped up in your career?
it was then, it's not now, but
Yeah.
absolutely. Everything revolved around that. It's all I did, and it was my focus. And like I said, it was just I see it all the time with young officers, but they get in this habit where when you're brand new and you get off FTO, the field training program, and you're cut loose, they start signing up for just endless overtime, like working as much overtime as they can to make as much money as they can so they can, buy the house, buy the boat, the jet ski, the fancy car, like all these materialistic things that, again, don't matter. Instead of just, going to work, getting off on time, or when you can get off on time, I should say, because, we never know, or doing assignments that are cohesive with your family, like being a school resource officer where you have a normal schedule, or maybe working day shift instead of the graveyard shift like I did, but truly prioritizing what matters. Again, because I found out the hard way that when I hit rock bottom, and I finally asked for help. Initially, my agency was very supportive. They had my back. They were getting me the help I need. But when it wasn't quick enough, when it wasn't fast enough for them, that's when they turned their back on me and abandoned me. And that's where I literally realized that I was just a number filling a position. And all those years of hard work and sacrifice and everything I did, it didn't matter anymore. It was either they wanted me back right now on the job, or they didn't want me at all. And that's the hardest thing is that, a lot of, and I don't want to say all, but a lot of first responders have some form of childhood trauma. It can be very benign, it can be very minor, it could be just like a parent who wasn't expressive, they weren't emotional, maybe they're working all the time, providing for you. Or like in my case, my biological father was a drug addict. He was an alcoholic, right during my early teen years. And that created an abandonment that I never really processed or realized the effect of that. And I just tucked it away, I pushed it away. But when my blue family then, decades later, when they abandoned me and turned their back on me, it also brought up that unresolved childhood trauma. And then it just, is that trauma, the battlefield trauma, the street trauma, and the administrative betrayal just all stacked up on top of each other. And it literally just brought me to my knees.
Yeah. Well, you seem pretty healthy now.
Well, that's the thing is like I work out 2 hours every day. If you're connected on my personal social medias, you would see that I'm always going to concerts. I'm going to hockey games, baseball games, basketball games, football games.
Living life.
I am like I tell people they're like, "What do you do now?" And I'm like, "I live life to the fullest." I really do. I savor each day. I appreciate everything. It's just a totally different way of life. And looking back, as horrific as it was, and people that read or listen to Relentless Courage, that they'll be baffled. They'll be like, "How are you even still here?" But what I tell people is that I wouldn't change any of it, because this has led me to my true path, to my true calling, which is to let people know, look, if I can do it, you can also do it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that we learn and grow the most, especially personally in life, through the difficult times. It's like, if I think back, like the moments of clarity and biggest lessons weren't on vacations. They're through the difficult, tough times of life. That's where you learn this stuff. So,
Absolutely.
do you want to just take a few minutes and plug some of the things that, the groups that you're involved with, obviously your book and anything else?
Absolutely. So I'll talk about the book first. It's called Relentless Courage, Winning the Battle Against Frontline Trauma. And I want to talk about briefly how this came about because I never envisioned a book. I never planned on any of this. But Dr. Shauna Springer, like I said, she's a Harvard graduate. She's a clinical psychologist. She had worked for the Department of Veterans Affairs for many years, helping combat veterans with post-traumatic stress and other issues. We didn't know each other. She reached out to me on LinkedIn right before COVID, and she saw the advocacy work that I was doing with my posts and my speaking and my podcast interviews. And we just set up an intro phone call. And during that phone call, she told me about the work that she does with the stellate ganglion block and some other things. And that's where I shared my story with her, the story that's in the book, the story that goes all the way back to childhood into current day. And we were done with that. She actually asked me, she said, "Have you ever thought about writing a book?" And I kind of laughed because I was thinking to myself that, like, I am burnt out from, just report writing for all those years in the military and law enforcement and really with post-traumatic stress. It's changed some of my focus, my momentum, some other things like that, my concentration. And so I said, "Yeah, I've thought about it briefly, but I don't think I can make something like that happen." And so we ended the phone call. And a week or two later, she hits me back up and she said, "Look, Michael, I cannot stop thinking about your story." And she said, "I've heard hundreds and hundreds of stories in my work as a clinical psychologist, but your story is going to help save countless people." And without even meeting her in person, she said, "I want to do this book with you. I want to collaborate with you. I want to make this happen." And I knew in my heart that this was the right thing to do. And without even meeting, we decided to do this. Literally, COVID happens. And we worked on this for almost a full year without ever meeting once in person. We would literally Zoom every single week for a couple hours at a time. And like I said, what makes this book so unique is that every chapter has two parts. The first part is my story told in my voice. But the second half, Doc Springer comes in and she breaks everything down, but in very easy to understand terms so that anybody, I mean, you don't have to be a first responder, you don't have to be a military member, anybody on the street can pick this book up and you will truly see the human side behind the badge and behind the uniform. And I got to tell you that I think everything truly happens for a reason. And I think us meeting happened for this reason. And the book, it's been a bestseller for over 40 weeks. It's literally on Kindle, Amazon, it's on Audible. There's hardcover, softcover. And I think right now it has like altogether like 825 reviews, almost 700 alone on Amazon, like written reviews, multiple paragraphs. And I tell people right now, this book will change your life as you know it. It has the potential to save your relationships, save your career, but most importantly, this book can save your life. And if you do read or listen to it, I personally want to hear from you. I want you to reach out to me and share your thoughts. So that's the biggest thing. The other thing, like I said, is I'm all over social media. One of the groups and pages that I run is called First Responders First, and I always post news articles, events, things from all over the world on there that all are focused on wellness and mental health for military members, first responders, their family members, their loved ones. So I highly encourage you to join that group and to check out those pages if you're looking for resources.
Okay, so you want to just for those that want to find you on social media, maybe spell out your name.
Sure. So the best way to do it is you can simply Google search me, but you have to put the SGT for Sergeant space Michael, MICHAEL, and then my last name, SUGRUE. Everything should come up. literally like 100 different podcast interviews, but also on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok or X, all those pages, just type in Sergeant Michael Sugru and the page will come right up.
Well, great. Well, Michael, thank you for coming on and sharing with the listeners. And we hope people, especially those that are out there struggling, will reach out to you, maybe read the book and find the help and healing that they need.
Absolutely. Like I said, there is help, there is hope, and know that you're not alone. But the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life, nothing in the military, nothing in law enforcement, it was raising my hand and asking for help. And I'll be honest, I was embarrassed for a couple of years after I did that. But now that I'm on the other side of this, I know it's the most courageous and bravest thing I've ever done. And if I can do it, you can do it as well.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for being a part of this much needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.